Scripture this evening. We turn to Matthew 26 and verses 47 through 56. Matthew chapter 26, beginning at verse 47. This evening I want to depart a bit from our usual treatment of the passage, and rather working our way through the passage, I want to take merely a section of it and enlarge upon it. And so it'll be a little bit different treatment. Lord willing, someday we might get back to this and work our way through all the parts of this passage. While he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I shall kiss is the man. Seize him." And he came up to Jesus at once and said, "Hail, Master," and he kissed him. Jesus said to him, "Friend, why are you here?" Then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the Scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so?" At that hour Jesus said to the crowds, "If you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me, day after day I sat in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place that the Scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled." Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. It's said that when the first battle of Bull Run took place in the war between the states, that General McDowell of the Union Army had some 35,000 troops, and about half of his troops were not committed to battle. They were unused. They were, you might say, idle legions. And you have in our text tonight, I want to highlight verses 53 and 54, what you might call God's idle legions. That sometimes God doesn't throw his full strength of the resources and power he has into the matter of delivering his servants. As Jesus said to Peter, "Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? Don't you think that God is able, that he'll hear me, that I could have all the resources, 12 legions of angels? I don't have to fall into the hands of these men," and so on. But in this case, the legions were idle. And Jesus was taken because, as Jesus said, the Scriptures must be fulfilled that it should take place in this way. What I want to do, I want to summarize first, nothing perhaps startling, but I want to summarize it and I want to develop it with you, and then we want to conclude it. The summary is basically this. When we talk about God's, let me say first, when we talk about God's legions, in this case his hosts of angels or servants that do his bidding and sometimes delivering his people, when we talk about then God's legions, we're really talking, when his legions are idle, I-D-L-E, we're talking about the times when God does not, with visible power, deliver his people. His legions, you might say, are idle. Now, what we can say on the basis of Scripture is sometimes God's legions intervene. Sometimes God's power comes in a noticeable way to deliver his people. We can also say, however, that sometimes God's legions are idle. As here. Parenthesis on that does not mean that God is powerless. The third element, then, is it would seem in the light of this that sometimes it is God's will to accomplish his purpose in weakness rather than in strength. And you see it here in the case of Jesus being taken and arrested before the cross. Now I want us to develop those things and think about them, and it just follows that pattern however you want to make the point. First of all, sometimes God's legions intervene. That is, sometimes God, in a powerful and a noticeably powerful way, works to deliver his servants. That's however you want to put it. That's the first main item. I think it would be well if we go back in the history of God's redemption and look at how this has happened. Briefly and quickly, let's run through some of these matters. For example, how God delivered Moses in Numbers 16 when he was threatened. There in Numbers 16, Israel's in the wilderness, and there are some fellows by the name of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And they come to Moses and Aaron and they say, "You guys have gone too far." Korah says he and his Levites want to also have the priestly privileges of Aaron. And Dathan and Abiram want to have rulership alongside and authority alongside with Moses. Dathan and Abiram say in Numbers 16, "You've gone too far, Moses. You're acting like a prince. You're trying to set up yourself with too much authority. You say you're going to take us to a land of milk and honey and so on. Well, we left one, Egypt, and you brought us out into this rotten wilderness. And here you are trying to usurp authority and so on." And so they were trying to really overthrow and reject Moses' authority, which God had evidently had clearly given him on the basis of Numbers chapter 12. He said, "Moses is unique among men. He's over my household like no one else is." But they were objecting to that. And so when they threatened Moses and Aaron, was about ready to turn Israel into chaos, Moses committed it to the Lord. And then he called Dathan and Abiram out. He said to the people of Israel in Numbers 16 and verses 28 and following, "Here's how you'll know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and it hasn't been of my own accord. If these men die the common death of all men, or if they're visited by the fate of all men, then the Lord hasn't sent me. But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground open its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, that is the grave, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord." And so when he finished speaking those words, Dathan and Abiram and their households had come probably kind of cockily to the openings of their tent, and they were standing there, and all of a sudden the ground split open and they were swallowed alive, and it covered them up and so on. The Lord created something new. But you see, Moses' authority as God's servant was being assailed, and God dramatically and clearly and powerfully intervened to defend his chosen servant's authority in the face of that kind of rebellious, unbelieving flack that he was given. So he did that for Moses in the wilderness. But he also, you go from 1400 B.C. to 1000 B.C. and you come to 1 Samuel 18 and 19, especially chapter 19, and you have David. It all started with a pop song. The lyrics went like this: "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." You can read about that in 1 Samuel 18. And that kind of bothered Saul, because Saul got to thinking, he heard it over country KISH radio. I used to sing those two-liners to some of my classes, but you have to put the right country twist to it, and I'm not going to do it because you folks would laugh at me. But at any rate, when Saul heard that pop song on the top disc, he probably smashed his tape deck. He was angry. And he eyed David. And he tried to, when David came in to play his kind of FM-type music to soothe Saul, He tried to nail David with a spear or javelin, and David escaped several times. He tried to commit David to battle so that the Philistines would knock David off, and David just had more success. He even tried to get his son Jonathan to kill David, and Jonathan would not do it. In fact, he tried to reconcile David and his father. He even tried to nail David at home, and Saul's daughter, Michal, who was David's wife, helped David to escape by night. And when Saul's messengers came to take David out of his bed in order to kill him, they found he was gone. And so in chapter 19 and verses 18 and following, David escapes. Here he is with his back to the wall. Where can he go? What can he do to get away from the murderous intent of Saul? David, who is God's anointed king, elect. How will he fare? And so David escapes to Samuel near Ramah. And Saul finds out that he's there. So he sends a group of messengers. He sends a posse to take David and to bring him back, to put him to death. And it so happens that we don't know exactly how it was, but Samuel had a group of prophets, the sons of the prophets, and he was kind of directing over them. He kind of had this Bible study group he was conducting, and maybe they were doing a little singing. We don't know exactly what it was like. But at any rate, as they were prophesying in that group, when this first posse of Saul came along, the Spirit of God came upon those men of Saul, and they started joining in the Bible study group exercise. Well, Saul sends another group, and the same thing happens. And he sends a third group, and it happens again. And Saul says, this younger generation can't get anything right. If you want it done right, you have to do it yourself. So Saul does that, and he goes. And when he comes near there, the Spirit of God, it says, came upon Saul, and he prophesied. In fact, it even says that Saul, too, stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. Everybody wants to know, oh, was Saul just sort of dignified naked, or was he naked? And that's the question everybody wonders about, and it doesn't really matter. Don't you see what the Lord is doing there? Here is David with his back to the wall. He has no defense. He has nowhere to go. He has nowhere to turn. And he's going to be snuffed out. And what happens when Saul himself, of all people, comes to do the job himself? The Spirit of God puts Saul in his vice grips and makes him prophesy and join in the Bible study group, if you like. And Saul is harmless to seize and to put David to death. The sheer power of God that just grips Saul and holds him helpless so that David can escape. Or you go to 2 Kings chapter 1 and you remember Elijah. And Elijah had done something that wasn't very good. He had criticized a king, King Ahaziah. This was about 850 BC when you meet in 2 Kings chapter 1, and he had told Ahaziah that he shouldn't have gone down and sought help from Baal Zebub in Philistia, one of the Philistines' gods. Well, he said, because you've done that, you're going to surely die from your illness. Well, Ahaziah decided he was going to do something before he died. He was going to kill Elijah. So he sent a group of 50 men with a captain over them to Elijah. Elijah was sitting on a hill somewhere. And this fellow said in 2 Kings 1, this one captain, 2 Kings 1 verse 9, he says, O man of God, the king says, come down. And Elijah answered something like this, well, you know, if I'm really a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven. Don't use that word man of God lightly. Let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. And fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. So the king sends another captain of 50 men with his 50. And he says, oh man of God, this is the king's order, come down and be quick about it. And Elijah said, if I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven. Same thing happened again. Finally, the third captain of 50 gets the point. And he comes with the right attitude and things are different. But people get all over Elijah. They're saying he's being vindictive here. Nonsense. It's none of the sort. If we had more time, we could explain it even more fully. But the point is, here is Elijah. He's alone. He's God's prophet by himself. And this king is going to snuff out his life. You don't think that he sent 50 men to get that one lone prophet just to invite him to come up to the palace and watch a movie on the new VCR, do you? He didn't. The reason he invited and sent 50 men after Elijah was because Ahaziah believed in capital punishment. and because he thought that Elijah needed to be capitally punished. He was going to wipe out Elijah's life. He was inviting Elijah to come to his own execution. And when his back was against the wall and he had no other resources, God protected his defenseless prophet with his own fire this time. But what about Elisha? Different guy, you know, the successor of Elijah. You go to 2 Kings chapter 6 and verses 8 through 17, and you see the king of Syria was kind of upset because it so happened that whenever he formed a military ploy to trap the king of Israel and his army, somehow the king of Israel always found out where the king of Syria was setting up his ambush or his camp or whatever. And he couldn't figure it out. He could never quite put the squeeze on the king of Israel. And so one day while they were having a military conference in the king of Syria's tent, he took a swig out of his A&W root beer and he wiped his sleeve across his mouth. And he says, "Now I want to know which one of you guys is the rat. Somebody's leaking information to the Israelites. They always know precisely what our plans are." One of the guys leaned back and said, "Oh, listen, king. It's nobody's being a rat. It's the prophet Elisha in Israel. He tells the king of Israel the words you say when you're on your army cot." "Ah," he says, "well then, let's get him. Let's go to Dothan, 60 miles north of Jerusalem. And let's surround it." And so they do that. And it just so happens that in 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 15 and following, the next morning, the man of God, that is Elisha's servant, rose up early. You can see him. He's got his bowl of Kellogg's mucilage as he goes out on the roof of the house, because that's the way breakfast was meant to be about 2,600 years later. He knew that, you know. And he was eating this stuff. And then when he looked up, he almost gargled his orange juice because he saw an army with horses and chariots was round about the city. And he said, went into Elisha. Elisha was in the house eating his oatmeal because it's the right thing to do. And he says to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" Elisha said, "Fear not, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prays, and he says, "O Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young men, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Yeah, God's legions were active, you see. Yeah, there were horses and chariots of Syria, but there were other horses and chariots of fire. He was able to see what was invisible, the protection of God, the mighty legions of God around his servant. Or you go to 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19, and you have the deliverance that God gave to Hezekiah in Judah. In 2 Kings 18 and 19, it was a situation where the Assyrian king Sennacherib had come up against Judah and against Hezekiah. And Hezekiah had revolted against the Assyrian lordship. And so Sennacherib says in his annals that he had reduced 46 fortified cities of Judah. Jerusalem was still standing. Well, Hezekiah said, confessed he had done wrong in rebelling against the king of Assyria, and so he sent him tribute. And apparently he thought everything was taken care of. They had evidently made an agreement. But then, and you read this, I could point to this in Isaiah 33, but then Sennacherib apparently violated that agreement and decided that he was going to reduce Jerusalem anyway. So he sent some of his bigwigs up with a big army, surrounded Jerusalem, and was going to try to, if they fought, to reduce it or besiege it or get it to surrender by psychological warfare, and then in classic Assyrian fashion to deport them, etc., etc. Well, Hezekiah was trusting in the Lord, but of course these men said, "Listen, here's the checklist. Here's all the places we've knocked off. And you know, not one of the gods of these places has delivered them. Do you think Yahweh is going to deliver you? Are you nuts or something?" And that's the idea. But what happened then? Chapter 19, verse 35, "And that night the angel of the Lord went forth and slew 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men rose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. And Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, departed." And sometimes God's legions intervene. There it was, the angel of the Lord. And we don't know whether he did it by plague, which could be very common in that area, or not. However he did it, doesn't matter the how, the fact that he did it. And Jerusalem was delivered. Well, what about Daniel chapter 3 and the way God delivered the three friends of Daniel? You remember that story. And about Nebuchadnezzar, who had this giant image, some 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide, set up on the plain there. This was sometime after 600 BC in Babylon. And he said, it was sort of a loyalty procedure, evidently. Notice that in Daniel 3, verse 2, King Nebuchadnezzar sent to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then he said to all these various people, "You are commanded, etc. When you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." Well, in other words, it's a test of your loyalty. All you civil servants, you will, you know, bow down and worship this thing. I don't care what other stuff you worship, but you will worship this thing, or the fiery furnace. Well, everybody does, except there were some evidently who didn't. And there were some of the Chaldeans that accused these Jewish fellows, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He says, "There are certain Jews, Nebuchadnezzar, that you've appointed to office, and they don't do what you tell them to do." And Nebuchadnezzar goes into a rage. He calls them in and he says, "Now I'm going to play the tape, you guys. And if when you hear the tape of this music, you fall down and you worship this image, well and good. If you don't, you're going to fry." And their answer is classic. Verses 17 and 18 deserve a couple swipes with your yellow highlighter. They said, in essence, "If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if he doesn't, you need to know that we're not going to fall down and worship this image you've set up, Selah." And so, you know how they throw the three friends of Daniel into the furnace with all their garb on and so on. And then all of a sudden, Nebuchadnezzar looks and he says, "Didn't we throw three men into the fire? But I see four men loose, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." And they come out. He finally calls them out, and all the entourage of Nebuchadnezzar gets around them, and they start smelling them. They can't even smell the sniff of fire on them. It tells how their hair wasn't burned. And so what happened? Well, as Nebuchadnezzar himself said, "God has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him." You see, God frequently, in a mighty way, has his legions active, delivering his people. But Jesus says here in verse 53 of Matthew 26, "You know, I am able to call to the Father, and he will put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels. But if I do that, how will the scriptures be fulfilled?" And so that leads us to that second item. 12 legions of angels. A legion had about 6,000. Think 72,000 angels could handle these guys here in the garden, Peter? Yeah, but we're not going to have them. Sometimes God holds his power in reserve. That's the second item. And you see it here in Matthew 26. Now you might think, that's strange, because we just talked about how God manifests his power in a noticeable and mighty way in behalf of his people. You know that song, the Palermo Brothers? Some of you probably don't even know the Palermo Brothers. You're not as old as I am. But the Palermo Brothers used to be a couple of people, guys that used to sing in the Youth for Christ back in the 50s and 60s, and they had a song that they sometimes would sing. "It is no secret what God can do. What he's done for others, he'll do for you." Well, it is no secret what God can do. but it doesn't necessarily hold that what he's done for others he'll do for you. You would think you know that what God has done for Moses and David and Elijah and Elisha and Hezekiah and Daniel's friends, he would do for Jesus. But Jesus says, no, there's going to be idol legions this time. Sometimes God does not have his legions intervene, but God's power is held, strangely enough, in reserve. Especially here at the cross, salvation would have to be purchased through weakness and not through strength, apparently. It was like the time in D-Day in World War II. Was a fellow by the name of Private John Steele who was parachuting. He was to land somewhere in a drop zone near a town about 5 miles behind Utah Beach. Some of these fellows, about 20 or 30 of them, ended up off their mark, though, and they were coming right down into this village where there was a garrison of some 100 German soldiers. And the Germans saw some of these fellows coming, and they didn't know what was coming off, and so they started firing, and some of these fellows had such huge loads of explosives that they were carrying on them that when they were hit, they would just explode. John Steele happened to see that, much to his chagrin, that he was coming down and he was floating almost near the square, but then floating off toward a church, and then he happened to see that his parachute was coming down right on the steeple of the church. And so there he was, dangling from the steeple, and his body itself was under the eaves of this church, and there he was dangling there. Well, he tried to cut himself loose with his knife, and he couldn't do it. His knife slipped and fell to the ground, and there he was. He decided, as he saw those bullets whistling all over the place, and he'd already been hit in the foot, he decided that his best hope was just to play dead. And so he just hung there, realistically dead, for 2 hours. One lieutenant who went by, American lieutenant, still remembered the fellow who was hanging dead from the church steeple. 2 hours later, after the Fuhrer had died down, the Germans cut him down and took him prisoner, but his life was spared. It was not by doing something in strength, not by manifesting power or trying to exercise himself, but simply in permitting his being in a position of weakness to remain, quote, dead, that saved his life. It's that kind of principle that you see in the cross. That sometimes God's legions are idle, and that when it came to effecting and purchasing our salvation, God manifested and accomplished that in weakness rather than in strength. There were no active legions bailing Jesus out. That leads us to a third element that we mentioned. Therefore, it must be true that, and this is where we're taking what Jesus says and saying it seems to have a spillover into the life of Jesus' people. It must be true then that sometimes God wills to accomplish his purpose in weakness rather than in strength. And that's what you see happening in Jesus' case with the cross. And I'm asking, can that also be true in the lives of Jesus' people then? Is it not true that we see both ways of God's acting? And when we get into trouble, it's usually because we don't see the multiplicity of the way God works with his people. Don't we see mighty deliverance? Aren't there some of you that could talk about mighty deliverances that the Lord has accomplished in your own personal lives? And don't we also see strange hardships or apparent non-deliverance? Don't we see those times when the final hour seems to go by and God hasn't met our schedule and we seem to have no deliverance? And so we have this, sometimes God exercises his legions to deliver his people, and sometimes they seem to be idle. In order to pick up that kind of paradox, I want to refer you to the Epistle of Hebrews chapter 11, where I think you have a good instance of it, and I wish that more people would pay heed to it. But there in chapter Hebrews 11, verses 32 to 38, you have the writer reviewing people who walked in faith. He says in verse 33 and in verse 39 that these people did this through faith. They were attested by their faith. How so? If you notice there in verse 33, he says these people, through faith, conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, received promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched raging fire, escaped the edge of the sword, won strength out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead by resurrection. Isn't that amazing? Look what God has done for his people. Notice that he just keeps on going, though. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and scourging, even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering over deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And they, too, were attested by their faith. These are God's people living by faith. Some are dramatically, we would say, delivered. Others are utterly destitute and pressured and distressed and receive no apparent deliverance. And they're all God's people walking by faith. Sometimes God's legions have been active. Sometimes they've been apparently idle. But that does not mean either that God is powerless or that his people don't have faith. I want you to notice that Hebrews 11, 35b through 38 is also living by faith. You know there are some, and you know there's a kind of theology or a teaching going around today who, if they saw Christians being sawn in two, would look down there and say, "Friend, don't you know that it's not the will of God for your life that any of his people be sawn in half? If you only had more faith, claim your possessions," etc., etc. Or it's not. You know, those are terrible duds. It's not God's will for your life that you go in skins and wander over, you know, deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. Well, it's a problem for us, of course. God cares for his people, and yet he allows them to go through that. But the point is, sometimes, whether mysteriously or not, God does withhold his powerful, mighty deliverance. When he does that, we need to, though this may not satisfy us, to try to put this all together and to say, sometimes God's legions intervene. Sometimes God's legions are idle. That it seems to be God's will. Sometimes, to accomplish his purpose in weakness rather than in strength. And when he does that, it doesn't mean that God is powerless or that you lack faith. But it means that God wills to bring his purpose to pass through weakness, just as he did in the cross of Jesus. I think we'll dispense with the last hymn. Let's bow for prayer. Heavenly Father, grant that we might be able to see sometimes a pattern in the way you work in our own lives and in the lives of your people from the way you dealt with your dear Son. You have called us to be sons and daughters of yours. Help us to be able to see and rejoice when you unload your mighty power among us and in our behalf. Grant us the ability to still go on plodding along in faith when sometimes we mysteriously don't see any deliverance. Help us to be content with you, whether your legions seem to be active or idle, knowing that whatever shadows are around us, we are always under the shadow of the Almighty and the shelter of the Most High.